This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Privileged, as always, to be catching up with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon on MSU Today for our regular update on topics impacting MSU and the world beyond. President Simon, thanks for coming back on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Russ. I appreciate all the work that you and your colleagues do.
Let's start with the Northwestern football team is at the center of an effort to unionize some college athletics. You opined on that with your colleague Nathan Hatch, the president of Wake Forest University, in an April 7th Wall Street Journal opinion piece, if people want to look for that. But what are the issues and where do you stand on them?
Well, I think the editorial speaks for itself, but let me sort of digress from a moment from that specific question and just talk about, I think, the nature of collegiate sports now. I think that the NCAA, as the symbol of college sport, of amateur sport, really, in America, is undergoing a lot of change itself. Part of it is new leadership, and part of it are changes in the nature of Division I and the revenue underpinning many, many programs. So the question is how to make the best possible decisions on behalf of student-athletes. I'm really pleased that the NCAA has hired its first medical director. Now, you could believe that's long in coming, and I would be among them, but I'm pleased that that happened. The Big Ten, the Ivy League, have been part of a concussion study for a very long time, really leading that conversation in college sport. Michigan State's had a neurologist on the sidelines trying to make sure that we, particularly in football, understand what's happening, and it's not simply a coach's decision or a kid's decision, for that matter. And so those are things that are part of this general dialogue that is under the rubric Northwestern, but are very important issues that need to be addressed in ways that are much more aggressive. And I think the NCAA has taken that on, as has the Big Ten. If you look at other issues about the question of cost of attendance, I was disappointed that as a board member of D1, voting for cost of attendance so that student athletes were on the same level playing field with other students who received full financial aid from the institution, that was overridden by the membership. That's caused a real careful assessment of what D1 should do, how much money is playing a part in decisions that are affecting student athletes, who should come first in the way money is spent. And I think those are discussions that are also occurring at the NCAA level in the context of D1 governance, that are trying to put student athletes and their welfare much higher on the list, if not the top priority list, as Nathan and I said in our editorial, that should be the top priority. That goes along with being sure that there's academic success. I think that there are lots of issues, and quite frankly, I don't see football players working any harder at their sport, being engaged any more fully in their sport than a soccer player and lots of other folks. Who are mentored, much like a research assistant is mentored, and that the key issue has to be to get people in education. This week, we celebrated the 17th student-athlete academic gala to recognize all the student-athletes who are performing at an extraordinary high level academically. There were football players among them. There were soccer players. There were people from the rowing team, people from the men's basketball team. So it is a matter of each institution being sure that they agree that their role is to assure that students are getting the best quality education possible, because that's something that no one can take away from you. And that's also getting lost in the shuffle of the sort of sense that for some reason we're sort of semi-pro teams. And that really isn't the case in, I think, collegiate athletics. And it's our job to make sure that academics are at the forefront.
And you've spoken recently, President Simon, too, about T-shaped professionals. And I'm wondering if you can kind of explain what that means and how MSU tries to prepare some of those.
Well, we're really pleased that we were able to partner with IBM on the questions of the workforce for the future and what it will take for individuals to be successful, not just in their first job, but throughout their career, and also help the companies that they're a part of be successful. And so this phrase, T-shaped person, has evolved. Some of it is based on work elsewhere. Some of it is based on the work that Phil Gardner has been doing over a long period of time as a part of the Employment Institute and the research that we've been doing in connection with employers. So what it means is that we know that students need to have extraordinary depth in a particular area, but they also have to have a set of other skills atop of the T that, mean that they can use knowledge in a context that makes it workable, applicable to a variety of situations. So they're not just, no matter what the situation, just applying the same rule over and over again. But there's creativity and innovation, a sense that they can work in teams, and the list goes on and on. And so what we're about, we believe, by the kind of education Michigan State is providing and wants to do a better job at, is producing these people who are T-shaped, who have enormous depth in their area and are very competitive, but also have a set of other attributes that will make them valuable to industry. And part of the neighborhoods discussion was to facilitate that work, because we know that it happens not simply in the classroom, but the entire educational experience. And so what you need are more what are called high-impact learning experiences. And they're easy to identify. They're study abroad, their research experiences. They're not just doing public service, but taking that and bringing it back into the classroom. So you're using your content knowledge. So you're a logistics major. The service might be to look at food distribution systems in the Lansing community, not simply handing out food, which is a good and laudable thing, but it doesn't necessarily create a T-shaped person.
Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon visiting with me on MSU Today. And President Simon, Earth Day is April 22nd. Being green at MSU is certainly a lot more than just one of our colors. Can you talk a little bit about, in general, the sustainability ethos you lead here at MSU?
Well, it's always going to be a work in progress because you inherit a built environment. You inherit energy systems that take time to change, no matter what you do. So we have a long-term plan, the sustainability plan, that guides us through decisions that we make every day about how we can be greener. The most visible pieces that you can do quickly are things like recycling. We're part of the Better Building Challenge from the White House, one of the few universities that was a part of that, to retrofit buildings, because we know that the built environment is more of a culprit for energy and energy loss than some of the issues that get more public attention. And those are things that you can do in an integrated fashion as you think about retrofitting buildings, and also as we thought about making our steam systems, the tunnels, much more effective and efficient. So we're really committed to the full range of this. I think the neat thing about Michigan State's plan is that it couples research with action plans that are developed on the campus. It also engages student, faculty, and staff and continue to update the plan. What you want of a university is always to have people who are advocating more than you're doing. So I think that's a good thing, because the campus is really concerned. Students are concerned about a greener planet, a greener environment. And so we want always those conversations that push us to consider new ideas.
BeSpartanGreen.MSU.edu, a great place to check out for more information on our sustainability efforts at MSU. President Simon, you were joined by several VIPs on a cold, sunny St. Patrick's Day morning to break ground on our facility for rare isotope beams. What's next now?
A lot of hard work. It's, you know, the project, because of the funding discussions, sequestration and all that, sort of hit a level almost a year ago with our review that concurred in June that said we were ready to go. And then we had this sort of space where we'd sort of be in a holding pattern, ready to sort of start. And so science has continued, design has continued, but not with the same intensity that it was when the project was really moving through all of its gates, much like a downhill skier. You keep picking up momentum as you keep going down the hill, but it gets harder and harder to make sure you stay the course. And now we're in that process of really gearing up for all of the next review, which will occur with the Department of Energy in June. And we know that we'll have to have more integrated plans in place. New systems will have to be put in place. The cryo modules will have to be built. I mean, that's a whole list of things that are behind the scenes that will get much more attention than digging the hole that we announced recently. But it's all part of a grand strategy to make this the best nuclear physics facility for radioisotopes in the world.
President Simon, you have worked a lot on breaking down traditional academic silos at universities, and one good example is the Building Winning Teams Executive Development Program that Athletics and the Broad College collaborate on. There's one coming up in June. Just your thoughts on that's a great example of collaboration, which you don't see a lot at universities, but MSU taking a lead in that area.
I think what I'm really pleased about the university, I think if you all the surveys we do of our faculty, of our alums and others really indicate that we have relatively low barriers across units that are institutional impedances. Now, there are always some because we're a very large organization and we're complex, but we really, among the big places, are doing this relatively well. And across units, housing would be another example, residential hospitality services and academic units around the neighborhoods, really extraordinary piece, as well as athletics. There are partnerships among lots of colleges that some get more attention than others, but they're still there. And those have to be organic. What I'm most pleased about, if you think about the neighborhoods or some of the other things that we're doing, they don't have to come to the top in order to be done. That innovation, collaboration are happening at the ground level of the institution. And it's when they can't happen that people are complaining more than saying they can't happen. And that's a measure of the institutional culture. It's one we need to continue to work at, because we know the grand challenges facing the planet are more and more complex and require more and more interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work. We talked about T-shaped people in corporations. They see them needing to have a strong, grounding in a particular area, but need to be more knowledgeable about other areas that may not be quite as deep in order to be able to think about what corporate America, what communities are dealing with today, what agriculture is dealing with today. You can no longer sort of just understand a part of agriculture. You've got to understand the supply chain and the business. You've got to understand the environmental issues, as well as what might be viewed 20 years ago as traditional productive agriculture. That requires us to be much more collaborative and also much more purposeful as that happens. And I'm really pleased that Michigan State is viewed as a place that is easier to do that than other places, and we just simply need to be better at that in the future.
Lastly, President Simon, commencement is around the corner. What are you sort of reflecting on as we approach the summer, and what are some things Spartans can look forward to in the fall?
Well, I think that the campus will continue to be vibrant with new ideas. And the great thing about a university is you can't ever predict exactly what those ideas are going to be. It's like the students, some of whom are going to be recognized at commencement or the ring ceremony that we've done. And talking to those parents and the students, we did the ring ceremony at Beaumont Tower. And that's a place that they stopped on their campus tour. And so I asked folks a question about when you made that stop on the campus tour and saw Beaumont Tower, you had some idea about what you wanted to do. And to a person, all of them said that Michigan State not only helped them to achieve those ideas, but made them bigger. And so we want to be a place, and we talk about next year, that will have bigger ideas. We want to be a place that continues to worry about the cost of education, but not in the context of simply the price tag, but because price tags vary. It's like what you would buy in a retail store and what you can buy in different ways. So price tags are an interesting discussion. It's really student debt. We're pleased that less than half of our students are actually leaving with educational debt, much lower than the national average, even though we're viewed as a high-tuition school. We're pleased that that debt is, on average, less than $25,000, while high. In the context of the value of Michigan State degree, it's much lower than the national average as well. It's much lower than the average in the state of Michigan. And so what we have to do is worry about price, but we also have to worry about value and return on investment. And that's going to be the big focus next year, is putting those two things together. I think you'll see more of the neighborhoods. You'll see some interesting research projects and ideas, particularly around computational biology. I think you're going to see a continued success athletically, whether it'll be a Rose Bowl or not. But we wanted, when we hired Mark D'Antonio, we wanted to build a program that had the opportunity to win championships every year and could be viewed as successful every year, even though we might not necessarily always win a national championship. And I think you'll see continued success in a number of Olympic sports that got very little attention in the press. But mostly you'll see higher graduation rates of student-athletes, experiences that make sure that athletics is a part of their growing up experience, not an end product of their experience at Michigan State. You'll see more student engagement and high-impact learning. You'll see more use of technology, all those things that are part of making this a world-class institution that is committed not simply to say we are, but to be better tomorrow than we are today.
President Simon, thanks so much for again sharing your thoughts with us on MSU Today.
Thank you, Russ.
That's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. Keep up with all that she's doing at president.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
It's always informative to talk to Michigan State University's Director of Campus Sustainability. She is Jennifer Battle. And Jennifer, as always, you are here to give us an update on some of the major sustainability initiatives that have been moving forward since our last visit. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Before we get into some of the cool stuff that Michigan State has been doing over the last several months, Earth Day is coming up on Tuesday, mm-hmm. and one of the slogans on this program is it's always Earth Day on Greening of the Great Lakes. What's happening on the MSU campus Tuesday for Earth Day?
Well, there is a lot of activities throughout the week because we can't just cram everything into one day. And we have some things both on campus to celebrate the activities that people have been doing, our Be Spartan Green Awards, our annual awards, and that celebrates people who have put in the extra effort in really looking at sustainability for their units. So our keynote speaker is Wolfgang Bauer, who is a world-renowned nuclear physicist and has a lot of other accolades to his name. And then also that week, we have our Greening of the Supply Chain Conference on that Monday, the 21st. So we're really looking forward to hosting about 100 suppliers and faculty and staff to talk about sustainability among the supply chain. So those are two of the larger events, but what I would encourage people to do, one of the wonderful things about sustainability at Michigan State is it's happening everywhere, and there are a lot of units and departments that have their own activities. So I'd encourage you to look at the university calendar and jump right in and join something.
Well, that's Earth Day Tuesday, April the 22nd, the same date it is just every year. And I know what you mean. The students are really all over things like Earth Day. I mean, they, and it seems, Jennifer, like the student enthusiasm grows year after year.
Absolutely. And we've always had a great history of very active students in the sustainability area. I can tell you in the last year, we've awarded over $70,000 in student research grants, and they range anywhere from carbon emissions from transportation to worm composting and everything in between. So I'm very excited working with our students this year, and every single year they seem to be, you know, I joke around and say that a lot of them are a lot smarter than me, but I try not to let them know.
Well, speaking of some of the projects that are going on campus, this is one we have not talked about. You call it torrefied wood testing at the Simon Power Plant. What is torrefied wood?
Well, to the non-scientists, I'll describe it as, think of a brick of charcoal, but it's made out of wood. It's charred wood. And the great thing about it is it can go through the same equipment that used to be used to pulverize coal. So for those areas that still have equipment that can process coal but are moving away from coal and into biofuels like MSU, we're testing this to see if it works with our equipment, to see if it produces the type of energy we need. The great thing is this is a partnership with biosystems engineering faculty. So Chris Saffron has been involved, as well as folks from the forestry department. So they've been researching this product, and then we've been fortunate enough to be able to test some small amounts of this of the torrefied wood in our power plant recently. So far, the first couple phases have been favorable, and we have the potential right now to, we're using about 1% biofuel at the power plant, and potentially we could use up to 3%, and this might be one of the ways we can get there.
Now, just for clarity, that wood that is being torrefied, some of that's going to be grown right on campus, right?
Yeah, there are some test locations where they're growing fast-growing trees. But right now, we have sourced some torrefied wood from other places around Michigan. But that is part of the research, yes, to look at a campus source.
And what about geothermal on campus? Something about the geothermal in the life sciences building.
Yeah, originally, we put the geothermal project in. It went in as a horizontal field, which is one way to source geothermal energy. And, you know, in the true sense of what we do, we really want to measure and evaluate the success of these renewable energy projects. And we felt that it wasn't performing optimally. So we actually went back in and put a vertical system in, and now it's performing a lot better. So again, when we're looking at renewable energy, we're definitely testing out a lot of different ideas and making adjustments along the way.
Well, one thing that's always been impressive to me about MSU's sustainability efforts, and you just alluded to it, whether you're talking about torrefied wood or recycling or geothermal, there are research and teaching components to this as well. It's not just infrastructure.
Absolutely. I mean, that is really the key of being at a university. We are able to work with some of the best faculty and students in the world in order to solve some really major problems, not only for us on campus, but then they can take that research and the students can take that knowledge and apply it elsewhere. So when people are engaging in sustainability projects, it just doesn't benefit Michigan State. It really benefits all of their communities, whether it's communities worldwide or communities where the students will go live and work. So that is a key component of our sustainability program, is that engagement, that broad engagement among our academic enterprise and our students.
And we featured several classes and several researchers in this program who have brought their students in to talk during the interviews about their enthusiasm for doing these sorts of research projects or hands-on projects or what have you. Another thing you've got going on, you're using something from General Electric, I believe, called the treasure hunt method for energy conservation. I haven't heard about that. What
we're digging for treasure. So, it's a great program. So GE has been using this treasure hunt method in a lot of their facilities worldwide. And what it is it's based on lean manufacturing principles and being able to go into these facilities and look for energy conservation measures. So treasure. So you're finding money, you're finding conservation measures. The great thing is you're taking a diverse set of people from the building. So typically at Michigan State, our facilities folks would go through and they would look at things and make recommendations, suggestions, and implement them, which yields energy savings. But the great thing about this program, which we piloted last fall in engineering and biophysical sciences, we brought together our custodians, the faculty, staff, students, and facilities managers with some outside experts, and you form these small teams and you literally walk through the buildings and look for opportunities. And so the perspective of the person who has no idea what some of these lighting systems do versus someone who's an expert, I mean, you just got a ton of different opportunities. I believe it yielded about 84 energy conservation measures in just 2 days with those small teams walking around. So the benefit of the treasure
and walking
hunt,
around, they walk through different buildings.
Literally, just walking through
the
buildings.
Campus.
Just the two buildings that we piloted. And we are going to incorporate this method into our commissioning process to see if it does really yield stronger energy conservation measures. So we're really excited about that. We'll be starting that in June.
My guest is Jennifer Battle. She's the Director of Campus Sustainability at Michigan State University. Jennifer, you put out a report every year on the progress that you made. I think it came out back in October. It's available online. But what are some other highlights of the progress made in 2013?
Yeah, we're really excited. We've been moving forward very well with our energy transition plan. That is the plan that's moving us toward renewable energy and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and doing it in an engaged fashion. So we've reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by 17%. And our goal is 30% by 2015. And we've increased our campus renewable energy portfolio to 15%, to 8%, and our goal is 15 by 2015. And we're calculating that similar to the way the state of Michigan does. So we're including our renewables such as our geothermal and solar installations and biofuel in addition to energy optimization measures. A lot of people are interested in our fuel mix at the power plant. And a few years ago, it was primarily coal, but I'm happy to report now that we've moved to 67% natural gas, which is a lower emission.
67% natural gas.
67%.
Already,
so, wow. And again, like I said earlier, at 1% biofuel. So we are moving away from higher carbon emitting sources and going to lower sources. And we continue to evaluate different renewable energy projects and other energy conservation measures to meet the goals of our plan. Waste-wise, we've done a great job. I'm very happy for our team, which includes Surplus Store, which reuses materials and repurposes
the
them.
Recycling center.
And the recycling center. And we feel that it's not only a benefit to the university because we have decreased our materials to landfills by 43%,
wow,
but it's also a great benefit to the public. About 40% actually of our recycled materials comes from the public drop-off station. And anecdotally, people have told me they've driven about up to 70 miles
wow,
from rural areas that don't have recycling to come and use MSU's facility. We see a lot of small business owners in the Surplus Store. It's a great benefit to the community where they can get gently used products and things that they need for their businesses, or other departments can come through and purchase gently used equipment. So we've been doing a really great job on the wayside. And then the Surplus Store then returns credits right back to the university. So we've returned about $1.2 million back to the university,
wow,
department. So we really are hoping to be a broad benefit to both the university and to the public.
You know, I've looked at the Environmental Stewardship Report for 2013. Jennifer, it's very attractive and easy to read. Where can people find it?
Oh, absolutely. You can find it online at sustainability.msu.edu/report.
Or you can probably just Google the Environmental Stewardship Report from Michigan State University.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking with Jennifer Battle. She is the Director of Campus Sustainability, talking about all the wonderful initiatives underway at Michigan State with respect to sustainability. Jennifer, we're going to have you back another 6 months or a year on ongoing progress reports on all of these green initiatives in Michigan State.
Thanks. I'd love to come back. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes a Richard Alley. He's the Evan Pugh Professor in the Department of Geosciences at the Pennsylvania State University. For his work on the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, he was recognized, among others, with the Nobel Prize. And most recently, he is the recipient of the very prestigious Arthur L. Day Prize and Lectureship that's awarded by the National Academy of Sciences. Richard, congratulations on the Day Prize, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You're going to be in Michigan on April the 24th at my alma mater, Albion College, and you're going to give a keynote address at the Elkin Isaac Student Research Symposium. Your speech is entitled A Brighter Light at the End of the Tunnel, The Optimistic Future of Energy and the Environment. Can you give us a snapshot or a preview of what you're going to be talking about at Albion?
Yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to being there. Great place, great people. I'm sure you remember that. So what I want to look at is first the value of energy to us. We use outside of us to drive and heat and cook and all the other things that we get more than 100 times the energy that we get inside of us from food. We can do all these wonderful things with our bodies burning cheeseburgers or whatever we burn inside of us, but they came from plowing and trucking and so on, using more than 100 times extra energy outside. Almost all of that is fossil fuel at this point, and the fossil fuel will run out as an economically practical course. The easy sources are gone. The first modern oil well was drilled in my state by people who saw oil leaking out of the ground. And they said, wow, if oil leaks out of the ground, maybe if I drill into the ground, there's oil there. Now we're fracking and we're drilling out in the deep water of the Gulf because the easy stuff is gone. So we have to find other ways. The glorious thing is that for the first time in human history, we can see other ways and ways that won't run out, ways that will power everybody on the planet just about forever. Because once you have real solar cells, real wind, real other renewable energy working for you, you don't run out of whales in the ocean that you're burning for whale oil. You don't run out of trees that you're cutting faster than they grow back. And you don't run out of easy oil. You actually have something that can scale to all of humanity forever.
Richard, you talked about some of the, and we're experiencing those, the so-called unintended consequences of fossil fuel-driven energy use. But talking about renewables, we're starting to hear about some unintended consequences for example, wind energy and impact, for example, on migratory birds. As we look at renewables and as we're optimistic about renewables, what about some potential unintended consequences for these new energy delivery systems?
Right. So anything, if you think about how much we have changed the surface of the earth to feed us, how much area we put into crops and into livestock and what have you, and that gets us, you know, the energy in our food, and then we use 100 times more than that outside of us. Any energy system that's going to generate that kind of utility for us is going to have some unintended consequences, whether it's fossil fuels, whether it's wind, whether it's sun. If you put solar cells in the desert, you're shading a tortoise and a cactus. And, you know, anything we do that's going to get us that much will have unintended consequences. That being said, the unintended consequences of renewables, the scholarship is very clear. They are much smaller than the unintended consequences of fossil fuels. In fact, there are papers, there's research that says that building a wind turbine saves birds because the avoided climate change would have had more impact on the birds than the wind turbine does. And so while it is certainly true that wind turbines can bonk birds on the head and cause trouble, you're also saving a whole lot of things by using them. In addition, the scholarship is such that wind turbines have a worse reputation than they probably deserve for hurting birds. So there's a paper that came out last year that looked at Canadian data. There's similar data for the U.S. And it looked through the causes of what kills birds. And, well over 100 million from cats, flying into cars, flying into trucks, flying into small buildings, flying into medium buildings, flying into tall buildings, getting mowed by people cutting hay, getting shot by people who are harvesting game, either migratory or non-migratory, nesting next to a lake that goes up and down when people are doing hydroelectric, nesting in a forest that gets logged because people are – and all of those – killed more birds in Canada than wind did. Each and every one of those I named, and a bunch more. And the numbers for Canadian wind were, hundreds of millions of birds killed in other ways, and 16,000 birds per year killed by wind turbines. So it's actually interesting to ask why we all know so much about wind turbines killing birds when so many other things are killing so many more.
I'm talking with Dr. Richard Alley, who's the Evan Pugh Professor in the Department of Geosciences at the Pennsylvania State University. Let's talk about, again, and I want to get into some of your work with the polar ice caps a little bit later on in the interview, but this whole business of climate change, there are still some deniers out there, but the science seems to be so strong. And so prevalent that the human beings that we are a primary cause of what's going on with CO2 emissions, et cetera. Is there really a scientific debate any longer?
In terms of the basics, there is not much scientific debate. We as scientists always know that we work with students, and students are bright, and they will find things that we missed. So we don't ever want to say we're sure, because students keep proving us wrong. But there is not another side on climate change. There is not a competing hypothesis. There's no holes in the understanding. It's pretty much physics. You burn coal, oil, and gas, that makes CO2. We produce in the U.S. about 40,000 pounds of CO2 per person per year. It dwarfs the 1,000 pounds of trash that we put out at the curb. And that CO2 interacts with energy. We've known this for over a century. The physics was old when Einstein started working on relativity and people started working on quantum mechanics that are now in your cell phone. It was really, really refined by the Air Force right after World War II when they were putting sensors on heat-seeking missiles. And the CO2 that blocks heat going out from the Earth to space also blocks heat coming down from the hot engine of an enemy bomber that you can see with your heat-seeking missile. And it's just physics. There's not really any way out of it. And so we are pushing very, very hard on something that has to turn up our thermostat with very, very high confidence. The changes that we've seen so far confirm our scientific understanding beautifully, but they're quite small compared to what we will see if we frack it all and we take off all the mountaintops and we do all the tar sands and find everything we can find. We can cause much, much bigger changes than what have happened so far.
The science does seem abundantly clear, but it must concern you and others who work in this area. I refer to a 2013 Pew Research Center survey that only 40% of Americans and 39% of Chinese view climate change as a major threat. We still have some work to do, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. There's a big communications issue. It is worth remembering, though, that how you ask the question and what you ask can make a very different response. And I have had the experience of talking to many people, running surveys to stimulate discussion in online classes and things. And if you ask what's the most important problem facing us, most people will pick a nearer term one. But if you ask, is this something that fits into our planning and that we can use science to make ourselves better off, you usually get much broader agreement on that. And we as people very rarely focus every bit of our effort on one problem. if you have a hole in the roof and you need to buy some kids things for the kids for school, you don't do one or the other. You try to figure out how to deal with both. And so we face many challenges right here and now, but the reality of the value of energy, the unsustainability of what we're doing now, and the beautiful opportunities for what we can do, I think more and more people really are getting it.
My guest is Richard Alley, the Evan Few Professor in the Department of Geosciences at the Pennsylvania State University. Richard, you mentioned the importance of young people who come up with new ideas that we haven't thought of. That was my career as well at Michigan State, and that's one reason that I loved being in the profession. But you also mentioned online courses. Tell us about this amazing new course that you're in the middle of. You just launched it this semester. It's an online course, and you have 28,000 people signed up?
We ran one of these MOOCs, these massively open online courses, called Energy, the Environment, and Our Future. And originally it was 44,000 signed up, which was just true. And then, you know, a few drop out over time. And based it somewhat off of TV shows that I helped make for PBS with just brilliant producer and director Jeff Ayn Styles and Erna Cugino, called Earth, the Operator's Manual, based on a book I wrote. And it is the book is the story of why energy is so valuable to us and why we can't keep doing what we're doing and what we could do instead, with more than 100 pages of endnotes. So a very friendly story and a very dense supporting cast. And then we've been trying to find ways to get this out, because it is ultimately a good news story. We really did just about run out of whales burning them for lamp oil, and we really did deforest the East for trees, and we really are taking mountaintops off and fracking and otherwise exhausting a resource under our feet, while we really can have an energy system that will supply much more than we're using now at an affordable price for everyone.
You know, you sound very optimistic about the future, which is probably in the nature of a university professor. If we weren't optimistic about the future, we probably would be in a different profession altogether. But how did all of this, you got started by looking at the polar ice sheets, in Antarctica and Greenland, and many trips and much research in that arena.
Yes, absolutely. So we work on ice sheets for three big questions. Will the ice sheets fall in the ocean? How do ice sheets move things around on the planet? And what's the history of climate in the ice sheets? And in studying the history of climate, I have looked at the crazy stuff, the big jumps in climate and the changes in ocean currents. And we've gone back and looked whether changes in the magnetic field could matter. They don't. We've looked at whether there have been changes in space dust. Not much. And the more you understand the history of the climate, the more you are impressed with how big a change we are making now and how important it will be to us. The old geologists drew lines and said, we will change the words we use here. This is the Paleozoic and this is the Mesozoic. And we're drawing the line here because there was this huge change in who lived on Earth and what they did. And 200 years later, people said, that was a big outpouring of CO2, but it wasn't as fast as what we're doing now. And yet, there were huge changes in extinctions, and so CO2 has shown up as the biggest control knob on the history of climate, and as climate has changed, it has really affected living things. And so going back and looking at the glorious complexity of Earth's climate history as written in the ice and the rocks leads you to a stronger and stronger understanding that we are making a big change that will affect us.
Yeah, you really anticipated my last question in the interview. Looking at those CO2 levels throughout history as a geologist, and now looking at the CO2 levels now, there is no doubt in your mind that it's an accelerated rate that's unprecedented in human history, and you attribute most of that to human activity. Is that fair?
The data are very clear on this. We have 800,000 years of CO2 record from the ice cores, different cores from different places, different temperatures, different snowfall rates, the same history, and we are doing something which looks very different.
Well, I've been talking with Dr. Richard Alley, the Evan Pugh Professor in the Department of Geosciences. He will be speaking in the Goodrich Chapel at Albion College at 7 p.m. on April the 24th. Richard, I wish you safe travels to Michigan, and it's been a pleasure talking with you. I thank you for your time.
My pleasure, and I look forward to being in Albion soon.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan Life. When I first came to Michigan State University in 1973, many of my friends at Ann Arbor Pioneer High School wanted to know why. There was a Big Ten school in my backyard. Both of my parents had earned degrees there. I had been accepted for admission. Why would a potential third-generation Wolverine want to come to East Lansing? My answer? I want to become a Spartan. I now realize that on that first day I set foot on the Michigan State campus, I had no idea of the true meaning of that word. It is only now, with the seasoning of the years, that I am just beginning to understand. Being a Spartan isn't a degree, a t-shirt, a title, or a trophy. It's an ethic, a lifestyle, a set of beliefs and behaviors that set us apart from the rest of the world, even as we work together in pursuit of a better life for everyone. A Spartan is something you choose to become. It is integrity, fairness, morality, honor, generosity, tenacity, kindness, and assurance, elements that combine to forge an iron constitution and a compassionate heart. Therefore, I am a Spartan. I emerge from the most modest of backgrounds and from the most prominent of families. The blood of every race, creed, color, and culture flows green within my veins. My story is uniquely mine, but I work together with others to become a leader, a lifesaver, and a world changer. I am a Spartan. I read the classics, create art, and study the fundamental laws of the universe. I unlock the secrets of science, create businesses, appreciate the beauty of a symphony, and the power of the written word, reforming the insights from my research into ideas that can change the way of life for people I will never meet. I am a Spartan. I may make three-point shots, swim faster, and run further, but I know that a broad, lifelong educational experience will contribute to my inevitable success on and off the athletic field. I am a Spartan. I contribute at every level, in every community. I feed the world, heal the sick, teach the children, and invent, improve, and envision great ideas that lead to great accomplishment. I am a Spartan. I create drugs, discipline, and doctrine that strengthen the weak, bring hope where there is despair, and prolong the quality and quantity of life for the afflicted until I can find a cure. I am a Spartan. I may not always score the most points, but I am never beaten. I learn from experience, get up when I stumble, and am ultimately victorious in every endeavor I undertake. I am a Spartan. I celebrate differences, knowing that if we can discuss and debate from a place of diversity, we are more likely to make the right decisions when we act as one. I am a Spartan. I have known pain, disappointment, and struggle, but I realize that only the hottest fire refines a Spartan's resolve, and it is both trial and triumph that build character. I may achieve success, but I remain humble because I know that the greatest among us are defined
not by our position, but by our kindness, caring, and humility. I am a Spartan. I am among the first to offer a hand to those in need, regardless of who they are or where they come from. When others complain, I seek to understand. When others give up, I go the extra mile. While others may dream of the future, I am committed to creating it. I am a Spartan. I believe that what has happened in the past gives me perspective, but it is where I am going that makes all the difference. I honor those who came before, seek to learn from those who would teach me, and live my life so that Spartans who have passed on will be proud. I am a Spartan. I live the core values of the institution that educated me and devote my time, talent, and treasure to create a margin of excellence that ensures, enriches, and sustains Michigan State University for future generations. I am a Spartan. My dedication to the greater good is unmatched. My determination is unbroken. My compassion is legendary. And the common connection I share with my 500,000 fellow Spartans sustains and strengthens me in everything I do. And when my earthly tale is told, and I look down from the precipice of the ages, other Spartans will stand beside me, just as every Spartan, past, present, and future, will stand beside you. We will pick you up when you stumble, guide you in the direction of goodness, and celebrate the day when you can look into the heavens and truly declare, I am a Spartan. Others may associate these things with their university, their faith, or their chosen profession. That's okay. Those who live the Spartan ethic, though they may never set foot on the Michigan State University campus, are part of the Spartan spirit, even though they may never realize it. If you would endeavor to incorporate these beliefs and behaviors into your life, I promise you that you will find fulfillment in whatever you may decide to do. And whoever you become, there will be a quiet voice within you that will, in its own unique language, someday whisper, I am a Spartan. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about the Spartan life at alumni.msu.edu.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.